please the court. This appeal presents the question, I think, how the district court should have interpreted and applied its own claim construction. Because in the Markman hearing, Visa argued for a very narrow construction of the claim term at issue, but the district court rejected that construction. And based on the language of the claim construction that was actually adopted, we thought SafeClick had prevailed, and in fact, Judge Armstrong said so. But then, on summary judgment, rather than applying the construction that we agreed to, the district court either inappropriately switched to a different claim construction, much like what it had previously rejected, or it erroneously applied the agreed claim construction to decide disputed issues of fact. And we'd submit that under a proper construction, that including the one that we thought we agreed to, there was more than enough factual evidence to support SafeClick's claim of infringement.
I thought the district court had ruled that the theory of infringement that you were propounding was one that they simply weren't going to listen to.
Well, that's true too, Your Honor, and we believe erroneously. I can address that issue first if you prefer.
If we agree with the district court that the theory of infringement you were espousing, which is massaging the password with the encryption, that you'd waive the right to make that argument, then case is over, isn't it?
I think if you agree that we waived it, yes.
Yeah.
If as a matter of law you agree with the district court,
why shouldn't I agree with the district court?
Well, let me address that directly. I think there are four reasons at least why that ruling was error. First, it was based on what we believe is a clearly erroneous factual finding as to what our disclosures showed. Secondly, and I'll get to each one of these in turn. Secondly, it was based on what we believe is a clear misapplication of the local rules and their requirements themselves. Third, it was that the ruling was entered without providing SafeClick a full opportunity to be heard on it. And fourth, and I think most importantly, there was no showing of prejudice. There was no finding of prejudice. There was actually no consideration by the district court of the issue of prejudice.
On the issue of prejudice, looking at A4132 in the record, where you were basically arguing that it would be unfair to apply the local rule to you, and you're saying the Visa does not even allege that it suffered prejudice in this respect. That's A4132 at line 20.
Yes.
I looked through the entirety of the record that was given to us to see whether there was any other reference to the issue of prejudice that you're arguing to the district court that there was no prejudice. I didn't see any other reference.
But this is the only place it was briefed. You recall, Your Honor.
Well, so I'm just asking you, this is the entirety of your prejudice argument that you made to the U.S. District Court.
That's correct. And
pretty flimsy, isn't it?
No, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. The first thing is, this was raised for the first time by Visa in a reply brief.
Prejudice was raised? No.
No, the issue
the
of
rule,
striking
the local
this,
rule. Right.
This argument. Yes, sir.
Right.
And
well, that's not unfair, is it?
Well,
it's not unfair of them to raise the issue.
It's not unfair to raise it, of course. I'm not saying it. I'm saying, and this was our response, and it made all of the arguments that we need to make. Number one, it made the argument that we, in fact, had complied with the local rule.
Well,
I'm
just trying to get at, because, I mean, and according to your brief, this is a pretty grand, large argument. You've got to look at Rule 36, 26 and 37, and they allied into the local rule, right? I never saw any of that argument being presented to the district court judge.
Well, Your Honor, again, in the context in which it came up.
And whether there's prejudice or not, it's a factual issue, right? So I would think that if one was going to argue that Rule 26 and 37 are hived on to the local rule, and you can't, even though there's been a violation of the local rule, there can be no penalty for the infraction absent prejudice, that all would have been presented to the district court judge so she could have understood what the whole argument was.
Well, the other thing that happened here, and this goes to my point about not getting a full opportunity to be heard, we were not allowed oral argument on this motion either. The entirety of the summary judgment motion, although oral argument had been scheduled,
you never asked to amend your pretrial order. And did you petition for reconsideration here?
We did not. We had a judgment.
So what happened is the case comes up on appeal to me, and all of a sudden there's this whole big factual predicate rolling around, and Klevner's supposed to figure out whether there is or is not prejudice, or actually what the local rule is.
Well, we've addressed this in our brief, and let me cite the case in particular. The Ninth Circuit procedural law applies to the question of waiver here. And we've cited the Smith versus Arthur Anderson case, which goes to this point. And what it says is that parties do not waive arguments in the nature of buttressing the arguments they made in the district court. And I would submit, Your Honor, that we made the argument that we had complied with the local rule. We made the argument that there was no prejudice, and that should be a determining factor. And now what we've done is to go back and get, as I say, in the context, rather than the context of a surreply brief, we've gone back and shown what the law is that supports the arguments that we made below. And that's what the Smith court says you can do.
Well, I didn't really, that's my point, why I asked you whether A4132 was the entirety of your prejudice Ninth Circuit Rule 2637 argument, and you said it is.
Yes, and I'll tell you, we had been prepared to address this at length in the oral argument. Again, because of the context and the lateness in the briefing in which it came up.
I mean, if a trial judge was going to make such a horrendously erroneous decision, I would think counsel would want to help the trial judge not to make such a horrible mistake by presenting the material in writing to the judge as opposed to a one-word reference to the subject matter. Well, this is one word. It says it's on line 20 there. That's it.
Well, I don't think it constitutes waiver to get to your point. And I think the law...
I mean, the up-and-up issue is whether or not your initial claim construction theory was broad enough to cover massaging the password with E.
Yes, I think that's true,
too. And the trial judge said, no, I don't think so.
That's what the trial judge said.
Right.
Now, we, of course...
And it's
not
abuse of discretion standard of review?
Yes, sir.
Then how can I rule in your favor?
Well, what I was beginning to go through what we believe are four instances that all constitute abuse of discretion. The first being that the judge based the ruling on what we think is a clearly erroneous factual finding concerning what the disclosures actually say. The second is that it was based on what we believe is a clear misapplication of the requirements of the local rule she was applying.
Your first disclosure, right, was where?
The appendix site. The page at issue begins at 2947.
Two different places.
And it carries over. You see, these are we took what was one element and broke it up into different boxes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and the factual finding I'm talking about is the judge's finding that we didn't reference the sending of the password at all. And I think what she did was to focus on...
Well, method of sending, right?
I think that she said we didn't reference the sending step or something like that.
Well, it's at 2948 was your actual disclosure, right? The private uniquely identifying is the authentic information entered by the cardholder, which is entered by the cardholder. I thought.
Yeah, and this,
so,
what you just said points up what we think was the problem with the way the judge looked at this below. And that is on 2947, in the box at the bottom where it says transmitting an acknowledgement.
Right.
Response, that is actually the beginning of the element that's being construed. And we just broke it up for convenience into pieces. And so when we talk about the transmission...
Well, it says the cardholder enters the required authenticating information, right?
You are where, Your Honor?
No, I'm on 2947.
Yes.
Okay. And then presses the purchase button to transmit that information being the authenticating information, right?
Right, and that's what we're talking about. It talks about this browser window opening. You see at the top of the box there?
Mm-hmm. And is the authenticating information the private identification code uniquely identifying the transaction or computer?
Yes, it includes that, yes.
Right. And then over in the explanation there on 2948, it says this private identification code uniquely identifying is the authenticating information entered by the cardholder.
Right.
Entered by, not entered by the computer, not entered by some software that's lying in the computer, right?
Well, that is true, but if you look at
the... I think that's what the trial judge was thinking, that what you said the first time around was entered by the cardholder, which includes the password, which of course the user types in.
Yes, I agree that that is what the right. trial court was thinking.
And so the whole nub goes to, okay, what you really meant to be saying here was the private identification code is the authenticating information entered by the cardholder, then massaged by software of some sort, and then transmitted.
Okay, and let me tell you why I think...
But I mean, that's your theory. So the question then is, right, could a reasonable person disagree with you?
Okay, and I guess the only thing I would disagree with you about is that I'm suggesting that the basic theory is already here in these documents.
Plus the fact that you've got a footnote to reference one, pages 2, 8, and 10, down at the bottom of the box, right, on
yes,
page
sir.
29, because that's where you go find out about the E language, right?
That's
in
exactly
reference
right.
one.
That's
where I found it.
That's where the SSL protocol was referenced, and that is what actually, and I'll tell you, there's an interesting issue here because...
Well, let me just put it to you this way. Let's assume that I'm a district court judge and I'm trying to decide whether you're right in telling me that this disclosure on 2947-48 was sufficient to put these on notice as to the entirety of your infringement theory. And the district court says, well, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. It's ambiguous. And if it's ambiguous, it's a violation of the rule when you're trying to clear up an ambiguity. You didn't file a motion to amend here, right?
That's true.
Which you could.
The ruling,
the local rules, the local rules provide for a circumstance when perhaps there is some ambiguity or that somebody might misunderstand. You can file a motion to say, well, what we were trying to say, Your Honor, was we're going to drag up the SSL protocol and everything because it's mentioned in the footnote. And, you know, anybody, any idiot would know that you can't have this private code that identifies the computer if all you're doing is sending the password. Right?
Right.
It's an insult to somebody's intelligence, including the district court judge, to say that the password alone will identify the computer because it can't. Because my wife can go to the same different computer in the same house and enter my password, and the receiver thinks that it's the same person, right?
Okay.
But my point is that if a reasonable person could try this could say, look, I'm trying to decide here whether you're right or whether the other side's right. It clearly, the initial language talks about the information that is being entered by the cardholder without any assistance from software, right?
That language in that box does,
in that
yes.
box.
But I guess my point is when you look at the transmitting portion, mm-hmm. what it does is it talks about this browser window opening, and that is all part of this SSL channel that's established. Now, in the
right, but a browser window can open, and you can type in your password without any massaging.
That's true.
In fact, the only reason why the password's going to work, as I said earlier, is to identify the computer.
Well,
is something has to be done to the password.
Let me address that because it comes up in the context again of why it is we were talking about it in the two computer, two transactions, two computers at the same time context. Because that example was part of an experiment that Visa's expert did and which was first disclosed to us at 10 minutes to midnight the day before they filed their summary judgment motion. And it was raised in their summary judgment motion as the proof that this password doesn't identify a computer. Now, what we said was that when you've got this channel and the browser window's open, what you know from the password being entered through that channel is that you're identifying the computer that started the transaction, and the password being entered then says this is the legitimate transaction or computer. In other words, it's being operated by a transaction or. I can get to that in the patent language and why we think that's the right definition of transaction or computer. So we were talking about it in this context, always in the context of a single instance. Now, what Visa's expert did was said, aha, I can prove that wrong. And he went out and he got two computers and he did this experiment. And then when we got notice of the experiment on the day of summary, they filed the summary judgment motion in the form of his declaration. Keep in mind that this motion was filed prior to the close of discovery, prior to expert disclosures having been made, and prior to any depositions having been taken of the experts. So what we did was say, well, we see what you're saying, but now let's talk about the detail of this secure channel that we've talked about, this window opening. And the detail behind that is that actually this SSL connection that we've referenced and that goes to this window opening, this SSL connection is different for every computer because it's a unique key that's created for each session and each transaction. So the detail that we provided at that point, although still part of the exact same theory that was always there, was needed to rebut what was a new counterargument. And so this goes to my point about how the judge, we think, misapplied the law. The local rule requires a chart identifying specifically where each element in each asserted claim is found within the accused instrumentality. We believe we did that. And we cited Visa's documents showing where we got the information. It describes the SSL protocol. It describes how this window opens up and how that creates this secure communication channel that makes sure that you're talking to the computer that started the transaction, and when you get the password from that computer, we say you've identified the transaction or computer. Okay? What the district court did was say we not only had to do that, but we had to anticipate this new argument that Visa would make and disclose our rebuttal to it. We hadn't thought about what would you say to the fact that you could do this with two different computers at two different times in the precise detail. Yet when that came up, the answer was there. It was there coming from all the things we'd already disclosed. It's just that we explained it in our summary judgment response for the first time because the argument had been made against us for the first time in the summary judgment briefs. So that's how, as I say, we got what we got, and that's why we think that the application of the local rules was clearly erroneous, because it imposed a restriction, a requirement upon us that does not come out of the language of the local rules. The language is a chart identifying specifically where each element of each asserted claim is found within the accused instrumentality, and again, I say we've done that.
Mr. Ferguson, just going back a second, on the SSL type of a situation. As I understand it, your argument is premised on the fact that the SSL not only encrypts, but also sends an authentication type of a signal to the verifying computer?
No, it's the authentication is that the password that the user has identified, which then gets encrypted, and then is successfully decrypted at the verifier end. It's in fact the right password. It verifies to the verifier computer.
To identify the individual sender, not the computer that's being used.
Well, what it does is it does two things. It identifies the computer as being the one that was at the start of this transaction. And it also says, and in addition to that verifier, you know that that computer that started this transaction is being used by an authorized cardholder.
And that's because of the password.
Of the password.
That's correct, because the password is right.
Let me see if I understand the mechanics here, and just stepping back from the legal question, but just looking at the mechanics. To use the example that's used in the briefs, I pick the password dog, and I send the password. Meanwhile, when I send it, my computer encrypts that password, pursuant to the SSL protocol, I suppose, into a form that the authenticating system will recognize for two features. One is it will recognize the fact that that says dog, and that therefore the fellow that uses the dog password is the fellow that's on the other end of the line or somebody that's stolen his password. But it will also recognize the style of encryption, or whatever, the features of the encryption as being particular to a particular computer that's being used in this transaction. And every time there's a further communication in the course of that transaction, it will know whether it's dealing with that particular computer, and to the extent that it's translating DGJM256 into dog, it will know it's presumably dealing with me. Is that what it all comes down to?
It will know that it is dealing with this, because of the encryption,
it will know that
it's dealing with the same computer that started
the same
transaction.
Computer, and because of the password, it will assume that it's dealing with me.
Based on the assumption that only you know your password.
Right.
Or that somebody that you authorized to use your password would use it.
But
it's an authorized transaction by the cardholder.
That's essentially the two pieces of information that the verifier gets from the combination of the password plus the fact that it has been encrypted by a computer-specific protocol.
Right.
Computer-specific encryption.
That's right.
Now, does the verifying computer remember forever that it was my computer? So if I come back a week later for another transaction to the same company I'm trying to buy some for, do they automatically identify me at my computer? Did I leave my cookies or something with...
The patent doesn't require that, and I don't believe the Visa system requires or does that. It's interesting because Visa has tried to distinguish their system on the ground that you can use the Visa system from any computer anywhere. But that really doesn't distinguish the patent, because the patent talks about the same thing. Even in the beginning part of the description of the patent, and I'll get the exact language, column 2 and line 9 of the patent, it says a single or multiple computer systems may act as the transaction computer at different times. And then it goes on to describe a system, which I'd suggest is very much like Visa's, where it says each of the transactioner computers is associated with one of the transactioners, or in other words, identifies a particular transactioner during an electronic transaction. And so in other words, what that says is that there can be more than one computer that can serve as a transactioner computer at different times, but what defines the transactioner computer is that it is identified with the transactioner for that particular electronic transaction. That is exactly what the encryption of SSL plus the password do in the Visa system. Now, I know I'm a little bit over, but I'd like to address what I see as kind of the key to the substantive error we believe that the district court made in looking at that question and addressing it. The claims themselves don't require a one-of-a-kind identification code, yet that seems to be what they say uniquely identify. And let me address, there's a question that came up below and that I think is the important question to ask. What does it mean to uniquely identify, or the way the district court construed the claim, singularly identify? What we say is it means that the code is the one unique code that indicates that the computer is in fact a transactional computer. There may be a thousand people that use dog as their password, but this code is the one that's on file with the verifier. There's only one code on file with the verifier that says, yes, this is an authorized transaction.
Like for that credit card number, you mean?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So that if I've got credit card 1234567 8,
what's it do if dog is a favorite password, just so long as it's not, so long as it's only associated with the correct credit card number, the transactioner will know that, the recipient will know?
I think that's right. I think
presumably they won't let more than one person have dog.
Sorry?
Presumably they won't
more than one person can have dog.
Well, I think they would.
Or do they?
Although I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily true that you could exclude everybody from having a similar password or the same password. However,
what do you do with two users of the card that have different passwords, like father, daughter?
I presume that would be fine. I've got the same situation at home, but I'm pretty sure my daughters have different passwords than me. But I would say that the unique part of it means that there's one password that will work. And it would be interesting because it doesn't say a unique code in the sense of there's only one like it in the world. It says a code that uniquely identifies. And I submit that means that it needs to be the one code that will work for this account, rather than saying it has to be a one-of-a-kind permanent identifier for a computer. But what the district court then did was to look at this thing called the man-in-the-middle attack.
But Mr. Ferguson, one quick item. The language of the claim is a private identification code uniquely identifying a transaction or computer.
Yes, sir.
So you still need to identify the computer itself.
Yes, sir. And that's where, in the context of the Visa system, what we've said is it identifies the computer as that term is used in the patent. In other words, it shows the verifier that the computer being used for this transaction is in fact being used by the authorized transactioner. Remember that I said that the way the transactioner computer is described is as the one being identified with a transaction for a particular electronic transaction.
Right.
Okay? So that by having the code that it identifies the transactional, that's the first part of identifying the transactional computer. The second part is that it is the computer being used in this transaction. So the code that says, yes, it's me, Mark Ferguson, I'm the authorized cardholder, you can tell because I have the right password. And then by going through this SSL secure channel in the encryption, you know that it came from the same computer that initiated the transaction.
As a tagline to the SSL encryption of the password and the other information which is transmitted.
As a result, depending on how you look at it,
it's the same computer you type the password into. Because when you type the password into the computer and zoop the passwords on its way to someplace for the credit card company to look up the number and say, oh yeah, Clevenger's password is dog.
Yes.
So they say that's okay with that. Something has happened to the password that allows the person that's checking the password to say, I know that this came from the computer where the person typed in dog.
Right. And that
can't be very complicated. That's not rocket science, is it?
I don't think that it is. I mean, not in today's computer world. It was once sometime, but I don't think today's rocket science.
Just as a practical matter, I mean, I can certainly see what the practical advantage would be of having a system that would give you a permanent knowledge of the identification of the computer being used by one of your clients.
Right.
So that if somebody shows up from a new computer, the yellow light at least goes on, or the red light. But what is the practical advantage in a single transaction of learning the identification of the computer? What is the risk against which that is a useful hedge?
Well, it allows immediate feedback communication to someone who is able to immediately say, yes, it's me, the authorized transactor. A lot of these credit card fraud transactions come up, or at least before this kind of system came up where rogue merchants would misuse client information. Bad internet actors would portray themselves as legitimate merchants, steal a card, get the card number, get right. other information, right. and then go out and throw out other
okay.
charges.
Sometimes sure, sure. Know. But where does the information about the identity of the particular computer for purpose of that transaction only? I mean, is that something you can then retrieve in order to find out where the merchant was, or what's the utility?
No. It's the immediacy of the ability to get feedback from the person who's in possession of the actual password.
Well, just to assume that the credit card company has never had any rules before on what a password could be, so it could be dog,
mm-hmm.
and they want to tell you they're going to change the rules, so it now has to be a combination of letters and numbers.
Sure.
So they can communicate right back to you, say, we're verifying dog, but if you ever want to have another transaction, you have to change your password. Is that the information that the verifier would want to send back to the computer?
No, I don't think that would ordinarily go back to the computer. But if I may, Jed Bryson raised an interesting point that I want to make sure I finish answering.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm clear yet. So.
Yeah, and the answer is that the idea behind it is you get immediate feedback from the person in possession of the password,
right.
which you wouldn't have if a rogue merchant had stolen, let's say, the credit card and authentication information that's on the card associated with the card itself. Because keep in mind, the merchant never gets the password. That's what this third-party thing is all about. So the merchant, even if he became a rogue merchant and stole all the credit card
right.
information, doesn't have the ability to to use a verified by Visa transaction because it doesn't have the password.
Okay, that's fine, but that is the protection given by the password, right? What I'm looking for is, in other words, suppose the rogue merchant happens to say to me, what's your password? And I foolishly say, oh, I use dog. Isn't that silly? And the rogue merchant then goes to the back of his shop and uses my Visa number and my password and sends that and makes a huge purchase or whatever.
Right.
What additional security is provided by a system that tells Visa what the particular computer is for the purposes of that transaction that isn't provided by a system that just makes sure that the password is the correct password?
I don't think the patent is directed to that.
Well, what is the...
The patent is directed to, and it talks about it in the summary section, a system that gives you the ability to get immediacy of feedback from a password holding card holder.
Why do you need to identify the computer from which the password was sent in order to get feedback from the password sender?
That's not necessary for the communication to go on.
Well, it is in this sense. It eliminates, and the patent talks about this, it eliminates the need to use things like fax and email, which are imperfect mechanisms for having this kind of communication. Whereas if a transaction is coming from computer A, and the message goes right back to computer A and is returned from computer A, you've got immediacy, and the mere fact of the message identifies the specific transaction and says, yes, that transaction, the one that was initiated by this computer, is authorized.
Well, is this no more than saying that every time I send a message over the internet, part of the message is the address of my computer? Is that all that's going on here? I mean,
it's
setting aside the encryption, I mean, is it?
It's different from the address of your computer. The address of your computer, generally speaking, is probably the IP address.
Yeah.
And for most people's computer, the IP address is dynamic. In other words, it changes every time you log on. Now, there is a separate a computer ID called the CPU ID, which is permanent to a computer.
Yeah,
and that is sometimes, and sometimes not, transmitted in connection with various communications that may take place either over the internet or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would say to you is that the patent says nothing about having to have a permanency to it. It does talk a little bit about the fact that you could possibly add audit features to something like this. And I'd say that the patent does not exclude the use of a permanent ID code, but it doesn't require it, nor does it require in this claim or elsewhere the ability to do an audit function. And of course, there are audits that can be carried out on the verifier side. They may not tell you the specific name or location of computer, but they certainly...
Are you in essence saying that a conversation can't occur between the sender of the password and the recipient of the password unless the recipient knows what computer the password came from?
What I'm saying is that the knowledge of what computer that password came from is a simple and effective way of authenticating the transaction that was also initiated on that computer. More simple, say, than a fax to the person at their known fax number or an email at a given email address.
But in combination with the password. So it always has to be in combination with the password, right?
The password as entered and sent in the Visa system
right.
is what we're saying. It
exactly.
always operates that
always
way.
Has to operate that way.
It always does.
But in the case of my rogue merchant who happens to have extracted from me my password, it doesn't do you any good.
If you give away your password, this patent and its invention won't protect you either.
So the information, there isn't any marginal utility for security purposes to the information about the particular computer for purposes of that single transaction that's conveyed to the verifier, right?
I think that's true. I don't think that's... In other words, I don't think this patent is meant to address that problem.
All right.
Although you could use this patent together with added features in a way that might.
Okay. Very well. Why don't we hear from Mr. Young? We've gone, to say the least, a bit over time, but we'll give Mr. Young... That's fine. Again, you were questioned extensively. We'll give Mr. Young some additional time. Hopefully that's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Let me address
the question. You don't have an obligation to use it all, but you may if you need to.
I will try not to, Your Honor. Let me address, with a couple of citations to the patent, the issue that the court was just considering with Mr. Ferguson, which is what the function is of having a private identification code that uniquely identifies the computer. There are several references to an audit function which require communication back to the computer that was used for a transaction. For example, at column 8, line 63, it talks about the faulty transaction request being communicated back to the transaction or computer to retrieve information pertaining to incomplete or faulty transactions. At column 9, this is on appendix page 8, line 34, there is further discussion there about communications back to the transaction or computer. Our brief cites the example at column 9 down at line 65, which talks about examining log files from the transaction or computer in order to perform an audit. At column 12, line 62, in the version of the invention that deals with transmitting documents, there is a reference to retrieving copies of the documents which are stored on the transaction or computer. All of these audit functions go to the security rationale that Your Honors were just discussing. It doesn't make sense for SafeClick's interpretation. SafeClick's interpretation or version of what it takes to identify a computer doesn't make sense in light of the overall rationale of the patent. It also doesn't make sense in light of the way the patent itself uses the word identify. SafeClick itself relies on a portion of the specification at column 4, line 40, where it talks about identifying a transactionor through association with a computer. Now, it's a little different because what we're identifying is the transactionor rather than the computer. But at line 41, the specification says, identifies a specific transactionor during an electronic transaction. The only way one can identify a specific transactionor is to be able to know which person it is who's making the transaction so that the person's account can be charged. And the specification in column 3 refers to credit card numbers as being one way to do that. In column 3, at line 43, the word identify is used again, where it talks about an account number suitable for identifying a particular transaction or and transactionee. And I would point to the words specific and particular in those uses of the word identify in this patent, because the basis for the district court's judgment on the substance was that verified by Visa undisputably does not tell anybody which computer is being used, whether it's the office computer, the home computer, the internet cafe computer. There is no way, unverified by Visa, to identify which computer is being used. In light of the audit discussion that's throughout this patent specification, that should be a dispositive fact. SafeClick's theory basically is a tautology masquerading as identification. SafeClick says, you know.
I have to confess, I'm confused now. You say that under verified by Visa, there is no identifying information to the verifying computer as to the, at any point, as to the source, the computer, the transaction or computer?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that.
What about, I thought that's the encrypted form of the password conveyed just that information.
That is SafeClick's contention, but that contention is incorrect. The only thing that the encrypted password does is say the password is being sent. It's being sent by the same computer that's commenced the secure transaction, so there's been no eavesdropping or interloping. And it says that whoever is typing the password in knows the password.
Oh, in other words, you're saying that, I think I understand what you're saying. You're saying you can't, from that information, you can't say, that's the computer that is in the upstairs bedroom of Mr. Young's house.
and you cannot tell whether it's the man in the middle computer.
Right, but you do know that it is the same computer that the person using this password used when the transaction
initiated.
You know that the cardholder is using a computer.
Right.
And you know that the cardholder is sending the password using the computer that the transaction is using. But you don't know, and there's no way to tell, which computer that is. And that's the crux of the district court's decision below. If I were to say to this court, I am the lawyer who is appearing in this case, my view would be that I would not be identifying myself. I would be expressing a tautology. And the same thing occurs in this case when SafeClick says, yes, the bank or the verifier knows that the computer that is being used for this communication, which is secure, is the computer that's being used for this communication. There is no identification of the computer involved in that. It is simply the statement of a state of being. Now,
Mr. Young, what about their argument that the computer is identified through the SSL encryption?
The SSL encryption of the password message does not function to identify the computer. As we cited in our brief, the SSL protocol itself states that in order to identify a computer, you would have a digital certificate associated with that computer that would convey information that was particular to the computer. The only thing that the SSL protocol does is assure the receiver that there hasn't been any eavesdropping or interference from in the transmission from the sending computer. It does not tell the verifier which computer has done the sending. Now, the diagram in the reply brief I find to be
rather interesting. Well, it says which computer, whether it was an Apple or IBM or whatever, but it does identify the computer as the computer into which the password was typed. I mean, you're arguing that uniquely identifying the transaction e-computer, right? If, for example, the person, the transaction e, person had five computers in the house, right? You think that claim language requires you identify which of the five computers was used?
That's what unique or singularly means, Your Honor, yes.
Well, it said uniquely identifying, right? That's what the claim language is?
Yes, and unique means different from everything else. And in order to uniquely identify or singularly identify a computer, one must have the information that allows one to distinguish that computer from other computers.
You get to the reply brief because...
Isn't that impossible?
It is not impossible, Your Honor, as patent owner or the patent inventor himself described, and as the uncontested evidence shows, it is possible through a CPU ID, for example, to have an identifier that is specific to a particular computer and that could be used to communicate with the same computer and extract the log files from that computer as described in the audit functions that are set forth in the specification.
How do you answer on page 8 of the gray brief, the Visa argues that identifying the transactional computer by matching the password, so on and so forth, this is simply not so. Verified by Visa transmits a password using encryption. In this way, the verified by Visa password associates the one and only computer that is used in a particular electronic transaction.
The only thing that the encryption does is say that the computer sending the password is the same one that was being used for the communication.
To transmit the password.
Correct. That's a tautology. It doesn't tell you which computer was being used.
Well, it's a tautology the first time it's sent. But for example, I mean, I suppose to take your example, when a lawyer stands up and says, I'm the lawyer arguing this case, if Mr. Ferguson stood up and said, I'm the lawyer arguing for the appellant, and later I were looking around the courtroom to find out who I should call on for purposes of making rebuttal argument, I would have that piece of information would be very useful. It wouldn't be tautological anymore because I would look at Mr. Ferguson and I would say, you're up. I mean, isn't that what's going on here? And isn't that specific, particular information identifying him, perhaps not by name, but by role in the so-called transaction?
It doesn't identify the computer or the lawyer in that case, because there is no way to track that lawyer or that computer down after the transaction is complete.
Well, that goes to the question of whether it's permanence or transaction specific, but I thought you were making a broader point that it really gives no information.
Well, permanence, I know that's SafeClick's contention, but let me analogize to the use of the word identify in the specification with respect to a transaction or.
Right.
The patent says a credit card number identifies uniquely a transaction or. You can find the transaction or after the transaction is over using the credit card number. Now, that doesn't mean that the cardholder can never change his or her credit card number.
Or somebody can't steal it.
That's true, and in which case you would change the credit card number.
Well, in which case the effort to equate the credit card number and the credit card holder would simply fail. I mean, there's some instances in which there's failure.
That's correct.
But it will generally identify, over the great bulk of cases, the
and
credit card
number. And
the purposes
set forth in this patent, which talks about the transaction on a computer, which has to have the same meaning in both the specification and the claims, being in possession of log files which can be retrieved after the transaction to perform an audit or to do studies about faulty transactions, the reasonable and necessary way of looking at identification of the computer uniquely is in the way that the district court looked at it. Now, the man in the middle issue, I think, clearly indicates that during a single transaction, not taking into account multiple transactions, but just looking at one single transaction, the system does not have the ability to identify the computer as being the one that is being used even by the transactionor, the genuine transactionor. The problem with the theory that's being asserted here is that the only thing that can be told is that there is some computer. Maybe it's the real transactionor's computer, maybe it's somebody else's computer, and that the password has been entered by whoever is using that computer.
But if the, I mean, short of the person that's trying to subvert the system obtaining the encryption system being used by the transactionor computer, isn't the transactionor computer plus the password going to give you unique identification at least for that transaction? I mean, what would be the circumstances that would lead to in an encryption system would lead to a misidentification in the course of the same transaction of the transaction or computer?
Well, there's no practical value in that kind of quote-unquote identification, if one were to agree with SafeClick's argument.
Well, that may be, but what you said, I think, was that the password doesn't tell us anything about the transactional computer. Now, why not?
Let me provide some definitions of identify, if I may. At page 82 of the appendix, there is a definition from the Modern Dictionary of Electronics, which says that identify in a computer means to attach a unique code or code name to a specific unit of information. The Webster's II dictionary, which is not on the record, says that identity is the collective aspect of the characteristics by which a thing is distinctly recognizable or known, a set of behavioral or personal characteristics by which an individual is recognizable. Those are definitions of the word identify which don't encompass the tautology on which SafeClick is relying for its infringement contention in this case. Simply to say the computer being used by the transactionor is the transactionor computer doesn't serve any sort of identifying purpose, and it flies in the face of the audit functions which specifically require that anything that's called the transaction or computer be capable of being identified so that log files can be recovered from it after the transaction is over. The district court had it right when it simply said, well, yes, they know I'm communicating with a computer because I'm communicating with a computer, but that doesn't tell them which computer it is. The password only identifies the transaction order, and maybe the ACS knows that whoever is using that computer knows the password, but that is solely identification of the transaction order, which the claim construction to which SafeClick stipulated below specifically precludes from meeting the requirements of this claim. Now, I would like to go on, if, unless Your Honors have further questions on the identification issue, to the procedural local rule issue. What happened in this case was litigation by ambush, both of Visa and of the court. And I'll go into the second part of that a little more. I think there's been a lot of discussion of what was said in the actual final infringement contentions, that DOG, in fact, is the password entered by the cardholder, that the encrypted version of that password is not entered by the cardholder, and in fact, therefore, was expressly excluded from the contentions that were made below in accordance with the local rules. Your Honors have noted that...
How was your client prejudiced by the violation of the local rule?
The prejudice resulted or appears in the fact that a motion was filed based on the claims that were made previously. The motion was filed based on what Visa believed to be the clear...
Is that a monetary prejudice?
There's
monetary prejudice. Cost you some money to do something before because...
Yes, it did, Your Honor. There's a CD-ROM in the record that constitutes an experiment which Visa had its expert perform in order to rebut, we believe convincingly, the claim that was being made in the final infringement contentions. That experiment cost money. Experts are expensive. As it turned out, that expert's experiment turned out to be irrelevant to the issue that was raised in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, because SafeClick didn't even pursue the theory, even as an alternative, didn't even pursue the theory that the password entered by the cardholder was the identification code for the computer. So you have a great deal of prejudice there.
Is prejudice required?
I'm sorry?
Is prejudice a requirement?
No, Your Honor, and that's a good point. We believe that this court should follow the Genentech case, where the court found unavailing an argument of prejudice. The reason being that the policy of this court in allowing district courts to enforce their local rules is to bring a degree of orderliness and timeliness to the disposition.
In that case, they found the argument of prejudice unavailing because they said you weren't prejudiced. I don't think they said there is no law that requires a showing of prejudice to prevail in a rule infraction.
The court emphasized the policy, and I believe you're right, that beyond the mention of the prejudice...
Yeah, they wouldn't have raised the subject of prejudice unless it was a requirement or a potential requirement. Well, what's the law? What's the law in the local courts out there? The cases cited to us in which, in the earlier versions of the local patent rules, there was an opinion Lowell Jensen wrote that dealt with prejudice, right? We wouldn't have been talking about prejudice if there wasn't some requirement.
That was a case that was brought under Rule 37, and Rule 37 does contain an element of prejudice. The local rules in this case simply preclude the assertion of claims that are theories that aren't set forth in the contentions. Those local rules do not require prejudice, and we believe that the abuse of discretion standard that this court should apply would allow the court in this case to apply those rules, and where a theory has not been...
I don't get it. I mean, in Jensen's opinion, he's talking about an Atmel case.
Yes, Your Honor.
That addressed local patent rules, that case, unpublished district court opinion. And then he goes on to say the court there found that Atmel's assertion that somebody couldn't show prejudice was unfounded. So they were talking about prejudice, right?
There was discussion of prejudice in that particular decision. I do not believe under this court's jurisprudence in Genentech or the local rules as they currently stand that if someone fails to put a theory into their final infringement contentions, that prejudice needs to be shown in order for that theory not to be able to be raised at trial. And there's good reason for that. And I think that happened to the court...
I mean, what happens if there's a confession of no prejudice? There's a rule infraction, right? and the infraction comes to the attention of the trial judge. The trial judge looks at it and says, gee whiz, this looks to me like you're advancing a different theory. And the party steps up and says, we haven't been prejudiced. The trial judge is in any event going to bar the argument? Is enforcement of the rule so pristine that in a conceded showing of no prejudice, the rule would still be enforced?
I believe that that would be left to the district court's discretion. The district court would certainly have discretion in light of a confessed lack of prejudice to give the patent holder some slack in that regard. But I also believe that if the district court wanted to say to the patent owner, you should have put that in your contention and you didn't, I've had claim construction hearings where I talked about this issue of how you identify the computer. Not once during that whole hearing did you even mention the issue of encryption to me. You never told me that the password could be encrypted and that would identify the computer. You went forward and you made the defendant spend money on an expert report and submitted a summary judgment motion, and it was only then that you came back and said that, oh, my theory is actually not the password is entered by the card holder, but the password is massaged by the SSL protocol, that the district court would have the discretion to prohibit the assertion of that theory.
Let me make sure I have the sequence of pleadings here right, because there was at least a surrebuttal pleading in the district court, and I just want to make sure I've got my hand on each one. You filed the motion for summary judgment predicated on the claim construction that had been proffered by your opposing side.
No, actually, there was a claim construction order in early April 2005.
Right. Right.
The summary judgment motion was filed in July, I believe, 2005.
Okay. All right.
And it was based on the final infringement contentions, which came after the claim construction.
Oh, okay. All right.
So it was claim construction, final infringement contentions, and then a summary judgment motion.
Okay.
Filed against those contentions based on the claim construction. And it seemed clear to us when we filed the claim construction, and there was some mention of common sense earlier in this hearing, that based on the claim construction and based on the final infringement contentions, that there was simply no way that there could be infringement based on that element.
And that's what you said in your
and we did say that.
Judgment.
In fact, if SafeClick had stuck to what it contended in its final infringement contentions, there would have been no issue.
So you're saying then SafeClick responded to your motion for summary judgment by saying, oh, no, that's not our theory.
Correct. They went off on a different theory.
And then the reply, it was the pleading in which you said you can't do this pursuant to the local rules.
Correct.
And then the surreply, or surrebuttal, I guess, was their response that they were allowed to file, I guess, on motion.
Correct.
To say why it was that the local rule, A, wasn't violated, and B, shouldn't be enforced against them in this instance, including within that the sentence that Judge Clevenger referred to about an hour ago, saying that there's no prejudice. Now, you did not then file anything further, I take it. There was
We did file one more brief.
Oh, you did. Okay. Now, did you say anything in that additional brief about prejudice?
Yes, we did.
Yeah. Okay.
We said something similar to what I just said to Judge Clevenger.
Okay. Yeah, that's where I was going. Now, where is that?
It's at 2953.
Okay. Okay. So there is, so in other words, in
2953, footnote 1. Had SafeClick asserted the visa.
$39.50. Okay. So the statement that Visa has never asserted prejudice was true at the time made, but is not true as of now.
No, actually, there was prejudice at the time of the briefing.
Well, when I say the statement was true, the fact that Visa had not asserted prejudice was true at the time of the surrebuttal memorandum, because you had never, in your original invocation of the
rule,
had not asserted prejudice, but you did in response to the surrebuttal memo. Is that the sequence of events?
Well, I know we asserted prejudice because I'm looking at page 4326. If I can turn to the reply brief, I believe there would have been some indication there that we didn't have the opportunity in our opening papers to address that issue. And I think it
would... Oh, yes, wait a second. 4326, yeah. And that is in your reply?
Correct.
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. So this is when you're saying, oh, SafeClick, you've sprung on us in your response to our summary judgment motion, you've sprung a new theory, and the rule, you say the heading number 3 of that brief says local patent rules bar their theory.
Correct. Right.
And you say down on line 21, 22, 23, that their failure to mention this deprived you of the chance to address the theory in your opening brief.
Correct. And that includes the expert submission and the brief. I would note that in that sequence of briefs, there was...
That would be true in every case. I mean, that a change of position deprives you of your... I mean, that's not exactly what's usually intended by prejudice. So otherwise, that would be present in every case, and you would always have prejudice. But beyond the fact that a change of position deprives you of your opportunity to respond to it until the change is made, which is tautological.
That was true in Judge Jensen's opinion in that Atmel case, too. It was the change in position which the other party had relied on in filing its summary judgment motion and in spending the money to develop that position, right, which turned out not to be addressed to the position that was ultimately propounded by the other side. That is prejudice. I would note that the sequence of briefing, there was a 3-month gap between our first reply brief, where we raised the local rule issue, and the supplemental brief filed by SafeClick in November, where they came forward with their rebuttal to that local rule argument. Mm-hmm. During that whole 3-month period, they could have asked to amend their final infringement contentions in order to address that issue and to set forth a claim based on the encrypted password. It would have been up to the district court judge at that time to exercise her discretion as to whether to allow that amendment under Local Rule 3.7. But in this case, SafeClick did not even give her the chance to do that, despite having a long period of time in which it could have done that. It was that procedural context in which the Genentech case arose. In this case, there's not even the opportunity given by SafeClick to the district court to exercise discretion as to whether to allow that amendment. In light of those facts, we believe that SafeClick has forfeited its right to state this encrypted password theory in support of its infringement contentions.
Okay. Have anything further?
Not unless there are further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Young.
You.
And you stood by your representation that you wouldn't use all your time. We will give you, Mr. Ferguson, your full rebuttal time.
Your Honor, I have actually a chart of the timeline of this, all this briefing that might be helpful in my rebuttal.
That's fine, and normally charts are not all that useful.
Haven't you submitted that to us already?
Pardon me?
Hasn't that been submitted to us already?
I can deal with it without the...
Well, actually, yeah, I think we do.
We do have that chart. Suffered no prejudice.
That's the same chart.
Right. I want to address the prejudice point in the context of the time because the real point of prejudice, and the courts that look at prejudice, look at the question of whether the person who is receiving what is alleged to be new disclosure has the ability to deal with it substantively in the context of the case. So, for example, when something is disclosed, as it was in Atmel, after discovery was all over, and after the other side has said, this is my final, and then changed, that's the kind of prejudice they look to, whereas the fact that you started with one theory in your brief and that's the only prejudice generally is not considered prejudice. But here it's even more, clear that there was no substantive prejudice because after that brief where we explained our rebuttal to Visa's expert experiment, all of the substantive discovery on that expert topic took place afterwards. Our two inventors were deposed afterwards, our expert was deposed afterwards, and there was an extended period, a 3-month gap, which was devoted precisely to completing that discovery and allowing for the briefing. And throughout that time, it's not as if Visa had to say, well, we're going to put it on a screeching halt. They didn't change their position, they maintained their position. So there's nothing that has been, from a substantive standpoint, prejudicial from the fact that after their expert first disclosed his new experiment, we said, well, here's our response to the new experiment. And they said, okay, now let's take discovery. They did take discovery. They finished and briefed, and that was the that was the time sequence.
How come you never asked to amend?
Well, the fact is, number one, we didn't believe it was a change to the theory that we had espoused all along. As I mentioned, the disclosures were always focused on this, on a single instance of communication through this window, which is mentioned in our disclosures, and which refers to the way the SSL secure channel opens the communication line. And the only time that it became important in articulating our theory to talk about the unique encryption was when the Visa expert said, oh, wait a minute, I can have two at once. And it was in that case, and it's kind of in reply, that we said, okay, that doesn't work either because it's a unique key for each transaction. Once having done that fully and completely with an expert affidavit attached to our summary judgment response, and then with all this 3 months of discovery happening, frankly, it didn't seem to me that new disclosure was needed. And again, as I say, I don't think it's a different theory. It really is not a different theory. It's just the explanation of the theory in the context of rebutting a summary judgment argument. So, I don't know if that gets to your question, but I wanted to move on to this thing about audits, because Mr. Young pointed to this language, for example, in column 12 of the patent, and talked as if audits were a required feature of this invention. And I submit that this column 12 language shows you that that's not true, because it talks about how at line 50 of column 12.
Right, but his point isn't that it's required. His point is that the claim has to be broad enough to be able to perform an audit. You said here. Right?
And I guess what I'm saying is that this one will tell you exactly why that's not true. It says the verified computer may issue a request over communications link, and it talks about how alternatively the computer may automatically upload. And then at the bottom it says this embodiment represents a customization of the system. And that's what I'm talking about.
Well, but what he's saying is the claim is broad enough to allow that to happen. It isn't required.
Okay. So long as
you'll be infringing. If you don't have an audit thing, you can still infringe. If you've got the audit, you infringe too.
What I'm suggesting is the claim doesn't require this audit function to be possible. And the specification language is pointing out that this is a customization.
He's saying, but if the claim is broad enough to allow the function to happen, then you've got to be able to identify exactly which computer it is, because where else are you going to find the files? You won't find them upstairs on the daughter's computer, you'll find them downstairs on dad's.
Okay, and I guess my response to that is the claim is certainly broad enough to allow that to happen, but by no means requires that there be a mechanism that would allow it to happen. In other words, the claim could encompass a system that has those customizations, but those are customizations and not the core invention. The last point I want to make is on the man-in-the-middle attack.
But he's also saying if you're going to have uniquely identifying, if unique means to the computer in question, he's saying, well, there's language in the spec that talks about being able to perform, right, the audit function. And in order to perform the audit function, you have to know exactly which computer it is. So he's using that language in the spec to inform the meaning of identify, uniquely identify.
Yeah, and I'd suggest that to do that would be wrong, because it's talking about a customization of what is the basic invention. So the claim itself doesn't require that, but you could customize what the claim covers so that it does.
Very briefly on the man in the middle.
I'd suggest this goes right back to this court's opinion or decision in Hilbrey, where if you can defeat the functionality of a system, it doesn't mean it doesn't infringe. And that's what's going on with Hilbrey. But it goes to what the district court did in looking at the man-in-the-middle attack, because what Judge Armstrong ultimately did is, as she was considering those facts, she changed the test that she was applying from what the original claim interpretation had been to a different verbiage. And I just want to read that verbiage. Instead of using the claim interpretation that had been adopted, she said, the patent requires that the infringing system singularly identifies which computer is sending the transaction. And that's the same thing Mr. Young said in articulating what he thought the requirement was. That is not the claim language, and it is also not the language that she used in interpreting the claim language. And that's what I'm talking about when I say either she resolved disputed facts over whether the encryption does or doesn't identify, or she applied a new claim interpretation that we hadn't agreed to and which was incorrect in the context of the entire patent.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.